This week, one of our most engaging segments was about presidential debates. Listeners not only called in with questions for the presidential candidates, but also explained why they often find presidential debates dull and boring. And so for this week's bonus weekend podcast, we've decided to showcase some of the most notable debaters from past campaigns and presidencies. In 2006, we spoke with James Carville and Paul Begala about some of the best debate tactics they used during presidential campaigns. And in 2008, I talked with the late Robert Drew about A President to Remember, his documentary about another great political orator, John F. Kennedy. These interviews reveal that while politicians almost always claim that they want to talk about the issues, so much of political debate is pure theater. So for our last interview, we highlight that political theater with filmmakers D.A. Pennybaker, Chris Hegedus, and campaign consultant Tad Devine. They joined me in 2008 to review four of the most prominent political films. Enjoy.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Democrats have been critical of mixed messages coming from party leaders and strategists. Back in January, I spoke about what's gone wrong with two of the best known of those Democratic Party strategists, Paul Begala and James Carville, and I asked them whether Maureen Dowd was right when she suggested that the Republicans can continue to count on the Democrats to play Judy to their punch. Here's how James Carville responded.
I like Maureen. She's a friend of mine, and I read her column, and I think that she makes some good points. In fact, she makes some of the same points that we make in the book. But I think that if we talk about some of the things she did, but I think a little bit, she's writing a column, we're writing a book, and we talk about some things that we can do to cure the problem that we have. I think she, to some extent, correctly identifies the problem the same way we do, but certainly some of the things she says I disagree with. But her thesis is remarkably similar to ours.
Well, in your book, you criticized the 2004 John Kerry election bid. What did he and the people around him do wrong, other than not listen to the two of you?
Well, they didn't have a message. The president had a message. It was, I am strong and he is weak. He's weak, waffling, and weird. He looks French, whatever that means. I never understood that, but it seemed to work. And everything they talked about in the campaign was about that. And I was here in New York for the convention. Every speech was Bush is strong, Kerry is weak. Kerry needed a frame as well. He didn't have to adopt Bush's frame, but he needed a competing frame. The one I suggested was the president has a credibility problem. He does not tell the truth, and I will. And Kerry instead had a list of issues, many of them quite thoughtful policy programs, but he didn't have a narrative. And without a narrative, you know, even a poor message like Bush's is going to be no message.
One person suggested that he didn't really waffle as much on the issues as he did on who he was. And we saw that right from the start when he came out to make his acceptance speech at the convention and saluted and said, John Kerry reporting to duty. Was he the Vietnam War opponent, or was he the American war hero, or was he the supporter of the war in Iraq?
Let's first of all start. Is the Democratic Convention of 2004 in Boston might have been the single most colossally stupid political event ever put on. They had a rule that you couldn't mention Bush's name. Now,
who made that rule?
The Kerry campaign. Every speech we had to go through them, and they censored out any mention of Bush. Now, of course, it didn't. And by the way, the most negative speech at that entire convention by far the best received speech was by President Clinton. If you actually look at what he said, it was a pretty scathing indictment of the Bush administration.
But they were, if I can pick up on that, James, they were most angry. We were at that convention, too. We covered both of them with CNN. The Kerry campaign was angriest. First, they were angry at President Clinton. I was sitting with him just before he went out to give the speech, and some dweeby guy came up to him and said, Mr. President, you can't give this speech. It's too negative. And the steam is coming out of my ear. And he was great. He's sitting there in this chair, kind of just paging through the speech. Didn't even look up and said, it's all right, son. I believe it'll work out just fine. You just run along. He was great. But they were even angrier at President Carter, who never mentioned Bush, but gave really a passionate speech about the need for truth and trust and credibility. And they hated it. The Kerry people hated it because it was too negative about Bush. It was nuts.
Well, I think a lot of people feel that there is a need for a certain amount of passion in the Democratic Party. Why do you think the consultants to the Kerry campaign were trying to take all the passion out of it?
Let's go to sort of a general thing. One of the really fun things we did in the book, it's really insider. You'd have to be an ultimate political junkie to appreciate it. But if you are, we have a chapter called The Meeting that takes every dumb thing that has ever been said in a meeting that we know to be a fact and accumulate it into one meeting. And what happens is, and it happens in Democratic campaigns time and time again, and I'd said this in one of my earlier books, they all go out to cocktail parties, and they really should never run a campaign from Washington. They go to cocktail parties on Saturday night, and that becomes the strategy Monday morning. Or somebody goes to a focus group in mm-hmm. Dayton, Ohio, and people sit around a focus group saying, you know, we don't like negative campaigns. We want to hear something positive. Well, everyone is going to say that. So they come back and make that an actual strategy. When if you look at the Republican convention, which was just savage, I mean, some of the ugliest, nastiest, untrue speeches given, it was actually much more effective than our convention was.
Actually, the nastiest speech was given by a Democrat.
Yes. Well, dispute whether or not he's a Democrat, but someone calls himself a Democrat, a dear friend of ours, by the way.
It was a classic distinction between the way those two conventions were run. The first obligation of the opposition party is to oppose, but then they also have to propose. I have to say, I think Democrats are doing a little bit better in 2005 and now going into 2006 than they were before. The third person who got in trouble at the convention, by the way, was Harry Reid. He's a senator from Nevada. He's the head of the Democrats in the Senate now. And he tore into Bush, and he would not let them change his speech. He was the only other person that I know of who got in trouble with the Kerry people. And I think that he has brought in a bit of a spinal transplant, as we say. I think Democrats too often lack a spine. It's why we wrote the book. But there are some hopeful signs. I don't mean to be – and I think where Maureen is wrong, and I love her and I admire her. She's such a gifted writer. But I think she's confusing – personalities here. Nobody thinks Hillary Clinton is weak, and she takes a shot at Hillary in her column.
Well, actually, what she writes, and because she's talking about the national security issue, which is the big issue for the Democrats, the one that they seem to be weakest on, as the White House drives its truckload, I'm quoting her, this is not me, as the White, don't write me angry letters about me being a knee-jerk liberal, as the White House drives its truckload of lies around the country, it becomes ever clearer that Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, and Al Gore are just not the right people to respond to the administration's national security scare-a-thon.
Well, let me start is that I actually think that the responder is one thing. The response is quite another. I think Senator Clinton or Harry Reid are positioned to respond. But I think that Democrats need to take on the national security issue head on. It wasn't the Democrats that got our army bogged down in Iraq. It was, you know, Richard Meyer said if we had to fight another war now, we would win, but it would be a lot uglier. We are less prepared than we were before. The single biggest contributor to the decline in the national security status of the United States has been the high prices of oil that have been driven by this administration's policies. If you look at the United States right now, people time and time again say, you know, I'm really worried about this thing in Iran. We are begging the French to take the lead. Why? Because these mullahs are sitting on billions, tens of billions of dollars because of high oil. Our army is we're in the middle of a mess in Mesopotamia. So I think that Democrats can make a real case that Bush has made the United States less secure as his policies. I think it's true, and I think we need to get out there and tell people that, and I think there's a receptive audience for it.
I hear the campaign speech is being written already. The mess in Mesopotamia. My guests are James Carville and Paul Begala, and they've collaborated on another book, their second, called Take It Back, Our Party, Our Country, Our Future. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Isn't one of the problems that the Democrats face is that there is a very distinct split between the liberals and the so-called centrists or moderates or whatever, although I'm not sure that's changed all that much from the old days when it was a split between the Dixiecrats and the Northern liberals. But right now, they seem to be the party that can't get it together, while the Republicans can really do know how to get behind the message.
That's a good point. The Republicans have their neocons and paleocons and all these different. They cobble together. economic libertarians who don't want any taxes with social right-wingers who want the government in your bedroom. And yet they hold them together. You got to give credit to Ronald Reagan, who put that coalition together, and President Bush, who holds it together. President Clinton was able to hold our party together, my party, the Democratic Party, together. But one of the reasons we wrote this book is we think that in the post-Bill Clinton era, there's a false debate going on in the party. Our liberal friends look at the party and they say, all these Democrats went along with President Bush's war and his tax cuts. And I listen to them and I agree. And I think that's right. Their solution is we should tack left. Well, then I listen to my moderate friends and they say, you know, too many Democrats are out of step with faith, family, flag, with traditional values. And they seem to be enthralled to sort of an elitist attitude. And I think, well, gee, that's right, too, which means they both only have a piece of the elephant, or donkey, I suppose, as you have to say here. So what we say in a book is that our problem is not ideological, it's anatomical, that you can win being liberal, you can win being centrist, but you can't win being weak. And that's what I think Democrats need more than anything. It's why we praise people like Harry Reid and Hillary Clinton, because they are strong. We need more people like them who will simply stand up and say, here's where I stand. If you don't like it, that's okay. Vote for the other fella.
Well, you joked about Zell Miller not really right. being a Democrat, but what about Ben Nelson, the senator from Nebraska, who's announced that he'll vote for the confirmation of Samuel Alito? Is that what part of the donkey does he fit in?
He fits in a part of the donkey. He represents the state that, you know, Bush got 70% of the vote. You know what I mean?
That's just practical political politics?
Yeah, you know, he's also quite conservative.
Yeah, he is very conservative. And it's also political realism. You know, but I know if I lived in Nebraska, I'd sure vote for Ben Nelson over his Republican opponent, whoever that might be.
There's still some cross pressures. Lincoln Chafee, the Republican senator from Rhode Island, will, I think, vote against Sam Alito because he represents a very blue state. You know, John Kerry crushed Bush in Rhode Island. So there will be a few of those cross pressures, but mostly the Alito nomination is dividing the country in partisan lines, which is a shame because the Supreme Court ought to be at least one of the few things that can unite the country.
Why do you think
the Democrats have stood up? You know, I don't know if effectively, but at least pretty unitedly against Alito, might add.
But why do you think that conservatives hate Hillary Clinton so much? After all, she has continued to support the war in Iraq. She just proposed a flag-burning law, which conservatives hate, even though you would have thought they would have liked that.
Well, I mean, why do conservatives hate Hillary Clinton? I mean, a condition to do it. I mean, I guess it's like,
it's just
Republican
genes?
Yeah, why do I hate liver? Because, well, you're not something you're not supposed to like, you know?
She's also moderated her view on abortion rights.
I don't think she has. Her view on abortion has been consistent, and it was in a book in the 90s, the same thing that she said. To some extent, there is a effort that Hillary is remaking Hillary in a way that I don't think that she is. She got on the Armed Forces Committee. She's always been a kind of a, in some ways a much tougher cookie than people expect. But due to conservatives hate her, sure. And is that a reason that we should nominate somebody? No, I don't think it is.
So how would you identify yourselves? Do you see yourselves as centrist Democrats?
I see myself as more probably. Most people describe themselves as an economic conservative, but a social liberal. I kind of describe myself, probably Paul's description to himself. I don't go out of my way thinking about it. Probably for a kind of an economic liberal almost. I believe the minimum wage ought to be increased. I think we ought to spend our money on schools and educating people right. I'm for very expansive health care. I'm concerned about the economy. I'm more concerned about the society. I would be willing to take something a little off of the economy to live in a better society, more just, people have more opportunities. I view myself as somewhat of a social traditionalist. I think of an intact two-parent family is the best, not you don't force it, but the best way to raise kids. I think there are certain institutions that we have in this country that we should respect. I think that religion is a great teacher because its ultimate message and its ultimate teaching is how we treat and how we live with each other. And I think it's very wise. And by the same token, I would not vote. I'm not in favor of overturning Roe. I'm certainly not anti-gay, and gay marriage is hardly something that's going to, you know. So, but I would describe myself as kind of economic progressive, a liberal, whatever you want to use, and social traditionalist.
And Paul, you have to say you agree with everything because you collaborated on this book,
talk
about we. You don't say James felt that way, and I felt this other way.
We largely agree. I think we're products of our upbringing. In my case, my grandmother's 92 years old. She's still with us. She came to this country from Hungary. She never went to a day of high school. She didn't speak a word of English. She worked as a maid. But then she got on with the phone company. She joined a union. They had to pay her minimum wage. They had to guarantee a safe workplace, none of which happened in Europe. She was in a system of free public education so my daddy could go to good public schools in New Jersey. He got aid to go to college. He became a businessman. He sold pipe. He was a salesman for the oil field industry. Raised us up, sent five kids to college, public schools, public colleges, public grants and loans that got me through college and law school. And in one person's lifetime, my grandmother's lifetime, she's lived to see her grandson, this woman who never went to high school a day in her life, become a lawyer and an advisor to the president of the United States. Now, every single one of those rungs on that ladder that I just named is under fire from my friends in the Republican Party today. They want to do away with the minimum wage, with the right to organize a union, with public education, with aid for college loans. By the way, the Social Security and Medicare that's keeping her alive in a nursing home today, they want to attack them too. So I have to be a Democrat because I'm an American. I exist today as a success story only because of the policies of people like Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson who wanted to widen the winner's circle.
My guests are Paul Begala and James Carville, who have co-authored Take It Back, Our Party, Our Country, Our Future. It is published by Simon & Schuster. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with James Carville and Paul Begala, who are not only political consultants, but media stars. And they have written two books together, the most recent one, Take It Back, Our Party, Our Country, Our Future, published by Simon & Schuster. So what is the collaboration process like here? You have to disagree on some things.
Sometimes, and so we leave some things out.
Is that it?
We just simply decided with that issue because we just can't figure out a way to come to terms on it. Or in the previous book we did, we had an argument where we just said, okay, Paul thinks this and James thinks that. And, you know, but mostly we've been in business together in one form or another, either running campaigns or writing books or doing TV shows for 22 years. So, you know, we're pretty close. James was in my wedding. I was in his. I mean, we're
friends.
Yeah.
But, nobody can agree on everything. And, you know, sometimes I might see something that Paul does. It's a collaboration. I mean, he really does the work. He's the writer. Sometimes it's something I might minor agree with, disagree with, but it's not big enough to some things in a relationship, you let some things go. I'd say we definitely are we are almost identical on how we think a campaign should be run or what a message is, almost identical.
Well, when you write in the book that Democrats should stop thinking they're smarter than everyone else, is this something that you both just sort of thought?
I guess better point, maybe a more elegant way to make it is stop acting like you know more than other people, or you're telling the great unwashed what they should do, or you're some kind of school mom and lecturing them. That doesn't work. That builds up the kind of resentment that we see.
And it offended a lot of people when Democrats suggested that George W. Bush was not the brightest guy in Washington.
Sometimes you got to speak the truth. there is a point upon which you have to take a patch of ground and stand on it. It may make you unpopular, but you have to say it. You know what?
The man is
not that smart.
But people like the way he moves, the way he talks, the way he's straightforward.
Yes, but less and less.
And they hate you.
Less and less. Well, I don't know. Mr. Bush, about as unpopular as any president since Richard Nixon. Who wound up, of course, being driven from office.
I thought that the press corps has treated him rather well.
I do too, but the country has seen through it. The press corps, as we write in the book, we have a chapter called Work the Refs, where we went through one of the great things about writing this book is we sat down with many of the top strategists for President Bush and went through and asked them, what do you do here and there? And one of the things that came out of it was this conscious effort they have to manipulate the media, working the refs. They beat and bang on anybody who writes or reports a bad story, and it has a huge effect. But even still, people see for themselves. Voters are smart, And the president's job approval rating is a good 20 or 30 points lower than Bill Clinton's was at the worst of the Lewinsky thing. It doesn't mean Bush needs a girlfriend.
That was because of Hurricane Katrina.
Because people believe he lied about the war.
People, his personal ratings are terrible. If you kind of 55 like him, 55 don't. That's one of the great myths. I mean, one thing is if you're going to rebuild a party, the party's going to have a strong message. If you believe something, you have to say it. And actually, most Democrats do believe. I know I certainly believe, and I think I see you follow it. The man is—he's vapid. How can you have someone that there is not an example of him asking a question about what would happen after the war that sent 150,000 people 7,000 miles away and has not the foggiest idea, curiosity, how he's going to get them back? I mean, there's no other. You could say he's resolute, or you could say anything, but you sure can't say he's smart. There's just no evidence of that.
But every day brings another embarrassing detail, whether it's preparation for Hurricane Katrina or whether it's what's been going on with the bales of money that have been stuck in footlockers in Iraq and people gambling with money that's supposed to go to rebuilding Iraq.
Right.
The mess with the with electric power in Iraq where they counted on natural gas, but they only built oil pipelines, so there was no way to deliver the natural gas to the electrical power stations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, the president still—I mean, you say he has low approval ratings. 40. He has a real hard 40% of America doesn't care.
Well, that's a very fluid number. Guess what? We ain't going to get him.
Got news. No matter what you do,
the 40% that look at massive corruption, massive incompetence, that look at
massive dishonesty.
Dishonesty. You know what? I got news for Democrats. They're gone.
Thomas Frank says that's because the Democrats have lost the culture war.
He has a point. We read his book and leaned on it some when we were writing this book. We have a point of departure with him, though. He looks at poor people who vote Republican, and he says they've been hoodwinked. Okay, I don't think so. Any more than wealthy people who vote Democratic. I mean, James and I now, God's been good to us. America's been good to us. We get those Bush tax cuts, and yet we vote against them. And when we do, we feel good about ourselves. We do that because our values matter more than our wallets. So it also is with poor folk who vote against the Democrats. They haven't been hoodwinked. It's just that we haven't spoken to them about their values. We haven't shown them. And one of the chapters here is called God is a Liberal. And it's something I believe. Liberals care about the poor. 3,000 times in the gospel, Jesus tells us to take care of the poor. Never once does he tell us to beat up on homosexuals. Okay, but Democrats have walked away from that. We can win these so-called culture wars, or at least get a truce, if we will engage and show people that we have values too and that our values are a lot closer to theirs than the Republicans are.
So why do you think a lot more Democrats than just Ben Nelson voted for some of the tax cuts that you, as moderate Democrats, are so opposed to?
I hate them. I hate those tax cuts. I'm ashamed of members of my party who voted for that. They were wrong, profoundly wrong, because at the same time they were doing that, in fact, there was one of the passages in the book, we say it's the day the Democrats died. They right before the 2004 elections, not very much covered by the media, there was a tax cut that moved $13 billion away from people who are raising a child on less than $11,000 a year. Can you imagine raising a child on $11,000 a year? We took away $1,000 from each of them, and we gave it to the richest corporations in America. Now, okay, I'm a person of faith. I'm a Catholic. That is a sin to me. And a lot of Democrats voted for that, I'm ashamed to say. And I think this is part of why we wanted to write the book, is to sort of shake up the party.
Yeah, you know, but the truth of the matter is we can go revisit. I don't know a Democrat now that doesn't think it's a good idea to rescind this. We talk about progressive patriotism. Yes, we're going to ask the wealthy to do something. But you know what? You got to be honest. You got to ask people, poor people, to do something. They're going to have to stay in school longer, get pregnant later. Middle-class people are going to have to join in this fight for energy independence and, you know, maybe drive a little smaller car than they're accustomed to. Everybody can chip in this country.
Well, the poor people are already sending a disproportionate number of their sons and daughters to fight.
You're exactly right.
They are, and one of the things I want to urge is that in the book, we put a recruitment form in there. Because the solution to military recruitment lies in the college Republicans. There are 120,000 college Republicans in America. They all need to enlist. If they support this war, they need to enlist. And there's an enlistment form in the book. They can snip it out. It'll be more fun than a Chi Omega mixer. But they need to go over there and fight this war instead of sending their brothers and sisters over there to fight it for them.
My guests are Paul Begala and James Carville, who have collaborated on Take It Back, Our Party, Our Country, Our Future. It's published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Considering the differences in the ways that Clinton and Bush have been treated by the press, why do you think it's generally assumed that journalists are liberals?
Well, let me, it's a question that I have Paul address, because we actually talked about it in the book. But
maybe that's why I asked the question.
What is an amazing thing, and people tend to forget, is you're right, they were treated completely differently. Look, what they did to Al Gore in 2000 is borderline criminal. And every commentator who has watched this, and some of them who I suspect are quite conservative, all say that. Now, this is true. In spite of this, and everything that happened, understand if Bill Clinton and George Bush ran for president today, Clinton would win by 10 points. Easy. It wouldn't even be close. So it how much of it was affected, but I'm going to turn it over to Paul about the press, because we talked about this a good bit, and a difference in a way that people would treat it.
The Republicans, and Governor Bush and now President Bush, had this idea that brute force, intimidation, would work, and they were right. They went right at journalists. If Frank Bruni, who covered the Bush campaign for the New York Times, wrote in his book, Ambling Into History, that when he wrote a bad story about Bush that suggested that maybe Bush didn't quite have the fire in the belly, Bush was sagging. He could see it. He was covering the campaign. He's a smart man. So he wrote a piece that said that. He was reporting the facts, as he should as a journalist. They refused to answer his calls anymore. They refused to help him write his stories. They refused to do anything, and they froze him out. And then they belittled and badmouthed him to his colleagues at the Times and his competitors at other papers. That has a chilling effect. And Bruni's very candid about it in his book. They did that across the board, and it worked.
And now he's reviewing restaurants.
Now he's reviewing restaurants and waiting on tables, I see, in the Times today.
We were wrong. We said we would advocate that the best way to deal with the press, try to be open, try to develop a relationship with them, et cetera. That's right. The best way to deal with the press is to slap them. I'm serious. And Bush has proved that. And you know what? I hate to say this, but they got a little bit of a S&M thing. Most reporters have a little bit of S&M thing. I think they kind of enjoy it.
Do you think that the political clout of Fox News has been overstated? After all, the O'Reilly Factor has 1.5 million viewers a night, which is a nice audience, but not overwhelming. In fact, it's very small compared to what the network shows get. But, and to some degree, he's preaching to the members of the choir, isn't he?
But to be fair, we were on his show last night. Let me be in the interest of disclosure. You're right, it's 1.5 million people, but it's more than anybody else gets on cable in one show. You know, I think Fox has a good bit of influence. Mm-hmm. And we point out how in the book we very, very candid about what Fox does, how it manipulates things, how it misrepresents things. We're not, don't back off from it one bit. But, you know, I'll watch it sometimes and I'm sort of amused at the stuff that they get away with. But Paul did a good job of research on that. I think we held a feet to the fire pretty good. And thank God for people like David Brock at Media Matters, which anybody listening to this show that really wants to get a take on what's going on in the media should do that.
That's a good point. To plug them, we don't have any relationship with them except as consumers of their information. MediaMatters.org. Every day, David Brock was a self-described right-wing hitman.
He's been on the show a number of times, on both sides of the aisle, in fact. Well, let's talk about some of the, we have very little time left, some of the issues. It looks like Roe v. Wade will be overturned. What kind of impact do you think that'll have on politics? Will the Republicans have lost their favorite anti-liberal cause in the culture wars?
That's exactly right, Leonard. It will be the worst thing to happen to the Republican Party. Because right now, 56% of Americans say they support abortion, fundamentally. So 56% majority is pretty good, but it's not overwhelming. As soon as they repeal Roe, which I think the Bush court will do, that will go to 75%. Because what did Joni Mitchell say? You don't know what you got till it's gone. And I think this country will rise up and insist. Some people don't like abortion. Some people do. They think it should be legal or not. But it will be resolved in the Democratic process, which will, I think, cost the Republicans dearly. Not only will they lose their best issue to rail against the court, they'll also lose on the merits of the issue, because most Americans already support abortion rights. And as soon as they're repealed, I think that number will increase exponentially.
You know what's going to – first of all, let me point out, Bush doesn't want to just overturn Roe v. Wade. He wants a constitutional amendment banning abortion. It's one of seven that he's for. It's one of my favorites. He's for more constitutional amendments than anybody in the history of America. I have no idea how you, a conservative, want to amend the Constitution seven times, but that's your business. The real tragedy is going to be is they're going to overturn it, and these state legislatures deal with really important stuff. Schools, a lot of health care, mm-hmm. how they deal with people, transportation, you name it. They are going to be, in a lot of states, are going to be paralyzed by this issue.
The Jack Abramoff thing is seen as a Republican scandal, but Democrats are implicated as well. And do you think that the new reform bills will have much of an impact?
Yeah, we take actually, Democrats are not implicated. Jack Abramoff has never given a penny to the Democrats.
Well, he's given to some Democrats.
No, he's not.
This is actually a popular myth.
It's a popular myth
we've been trying to combat.
Right. Charles Rangel, a liberal here from New York.
This is what the press does. They conflate Indian tribes, some of which Abramoff represented, who did give to Democrats, with Abramoff. Now, here's the difference. The tribes gave to people who, in whose state there are tribes and casinos. So New York, Nevada, North Dakota, places like that.
And traditionally,
Democratic.
Traditionally been Democratic.
But in all of there's been huge investigations on this. There's a Senate investigation. There's a federal investigation. Reams of information has come out. Thousands of emails. There's not a single piece of information that suggests that Abramoff directed any of the Democratic contributions, and there's tons that he directed all the Republicans. So I think we lump together perfectly honorable contributions from Indian tribes who support Democrats with the really scummy contributions from Mr. Abramoff, who was buying access and influence.
And Mr. Abramoff gave $127,000 himself of political contributions, not a penny to Democrats. He was a Bush pioneer.
There's a great rush to raise
$100,000. Sometimes there's a great rush. And the press loves a pox on both of your houses. I'm not saying Democrats are all honest.
And there were Democratic excesses in the past when the Democrats
controlled
Congress.
You know, it was embarrassing, though. We were scamming stamps. Even our scandals are still kind of, we can't even get a good scandal going.
Let's talk about gun control for a moment. You think the Democrats have to take a more moderate view and that it's a states' rights issue. But New Yorkers have a different view on this. In fact, the Daily News wrote this recently. NYPD officials say that 70% of guns used to commit crimes in the city in the first half of 2005 came from six states, Florida, Georgia, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Pennsylvania, all of which have looser gun laws than New York. Victims included NYPD officer Dylan Stewart, who used to work at the station, by the way, who was gunned down by a 9mm Glock stolen in Florida and later used to shoot up a Brooklyn nightclub. How can this be a states' rights issue?
Well, what we argue is that we should accept the surrender of the NRA. The NRA now says let's strictly enforce the laws that are on the books. Well, when James and I were working for Bill Clinton, the NRA opposed every one of those laws. So they are now endorsing the Clinton-era gun laws, which are pretty good and pretty strict. I think that if we were to try, and there have been experiments where we strictly enforce those federal gun laws, crime goes way down. It was a U.S. attorney in Richmond, Virginia, appointed by Bill Clinton, who started something called Project Exile, where they tacked another 5 years onto the sentence, and they prosecuted it. And gun crime went way down. Here's the problem. Federal prosecutors and federal judges don't like gun cases. They want to leave them to state and local prosecutors who are already overwhelmed. Federal prosecutors want to do the fancy, do the mob cases or the big drug cases or the terrorism cases. Well, tough luck. We pay them a lot of money. They get good benefits. Those judges are there for life. I think we should strictly enforce those federal gun laws. And, the only new law anybody's proposing now is that Joe Lieberman and John McCain want to close the gun show loophole, which we did some research. There's only 1.7% of guns used in crimes that are purchased at gun shows. They're more stolen, like the one that was used to murder this cop. Our own view is that the evidence suggests that the Clinton laws are working. We just have to enforce them more strongly.
I forgot to mention Joe Lieberman when we were talking about conservative Democrats. I just want to touch one other thing because we've really run out of time.
Okay.
I want to know about the K Street program and how that is what it imagines it will do to Rick Santorum's political future.
Well, look, the whole K Street project, we talked about this, so I'm going to turn it over to him. I want to make one quick point. Before I turn it, why should anybody be surprised at any about this? You got to give the Republicans credit. They were very upfront about what they wanted to do. They were very upfront about the close embrace they had with the lobbying community. Rick Santorum bragged about it. I mean, I don't know how he's running away from it now.
Yeah, Santorum, in fact, was a lobbyist before he became a senator. Usually they do it the other way around. They become a senator and then they go.
Didn't he lobby for the Wrestling Federation?
He did. He lobbied for the World Wrestling Federation, which I kind of like, but I don't think he was trying to tighten up the steroids laws for for the wrestlers, But he's quite a character. He presided, this K Street Project was this. Powerful senators, principally Santorum, and Tom DeLay, the Republican leader in the House, once a week or so would meet with lobbyists and strong-arm them, these special interest groups, these corporate lobbying agencies, into hiring Republicans, their friends and their staffers. It was this old Tammany Hall thing. Then those staffers and friends and politicians who became lobbyists would get rich, and they'd funnel money right back to Santorum and to the Republicans. It's the most corrupt thing you can imagine. When Nicholas Confessori, who's now with the New York Times, reported on this for the Washington Monthly, Santorum said, "I consider it good government." Well, now he's running away from it like the devil runs from holy water, but he has been at the heart of the most fundamentally corrupt, if legal, still corrupt, enterprise that we've seen in Washington in a long time.
And but his name doesn't pop up the way Tom DeLay's does.
Not yet. I hope that it will.
It's getting out there. You know, and look, we talked about the Monday night, $22 billion. These lobbyists that were in there with Charles Grassley and Bill Thomas, I bet you they were part of the K Street Project. $22
billion. We have to end it here, unfortunately. I'm having a lot of fun. James Carville, Paul Begala, Take It Back, Our Party, Our Country, Our Future is published by Simon & Schuster. Robert Drew has been a pioneer in the American cinema verite movement ever since 1960, when he developed the first sync sound motion picture cameras small enough to film almost anywhere. His subject at the time was Senator John F. Kennedy as he campaigned for the Democratic presidential nomination. And Mr. Drew went on to complete three more Kennedy films following him throughout his presidency. Now 48 years and over 60 documentaries later, he's put together a new film that combines footage from the four Kennedy films. A President to Remember in the Company of John F. Kennedy is being screened at the Tribeca Film Festival tonight and Sunday, and I'm very pleased that it brings Robert Drew back to the show today. Hello.
Well, hello.
Was it called Cinema Verite or Direct Cinema at the time?
No, that title got applied to it by other people later. I called it Candid Drama.
And when did you come up with the idea for doing this? Was it totally your idea?
Yes. Well, I was at Life magazine for 15 years as a correspondent and as an editor. And
so you're doing still photography?
This was still photography. And near the end of that 15 years, I kept running into television people who would say, I would leave a building after a story, and some people with tripods would holler, "What went on? What happened? What happened in there?" And I would laugh, but after a while, I began to think, why aren't they in there? You know, why aren't they covering the way we are? And and I actually decided to make a film, and I found out why.
Because the camera's just too big and bulky, and you had to have separate sound equipment. And
that's right. A crew of eight and a camera that took three people to carry. And but after a while, I got interested in the puzzle of why can't we develop this as a form of reporting? What we're doing in Life in still pictures, do it in motion pictures. And that took some years, actually 5 years of working to come up with the camera that you could carry, that we called it portable. It was weighed 50 pounds with the battery and so forth.
Now they're a lot lighter than that.
They were down to one pound.
Well, that was pre-digital. Your first Kennedy film covered his presidential run. What were the subjects of the other Kennedy films?
After Kennedy saw my first film on him in primary, which was called Primary, he asked me what I wanted to do next.
Because he had to be very pleased.
Well, I knew he was pleased. We were at his house in Florida. I knew he was pleased when he hollered, "Get Joe out here." Joe was his father, who was in a wheelchair. They wheeled Joe out and made him look at the rest of Primary. So I knew Kennedy liked it, and afterward, he and Jacqueline, or his wife, were most effusive, really. And Kennedy called me aside and said, "What do you want to do next?" And I said, "I want to make a film on a president with his back to the wall, making decisions in a crisis."
Well, you didn't know he was going to have so many crises.
No. And I didn't know he was going to agree, because that's a radical thought, to have the camera with the president all the time. Kennedy said, yes, what if I could see what happened in the White House in the 24 hours before FDR declared war on Japan? And he'd taken the idea and run with it much farther than I'd thought.
Well, I'm sure there were many moments he didn't want you around, and Jackie Kennedy was well known as somebody who really prized her privacy. They had young children. I'm sure they didn't want their privacy invaded. So did he call you and say, hey, I think there's a Cuban missile crisis brewing, come by?
No. He did two things. One, he called Jacqueline over after we talked for a while and said, Bob and I are talking about ways to use his new candid photography. And one thought is that a team will move into the Oval Office with me, and another team would move into the White House with you. And Jacqueline, who had been very friendly, turned unfriendly and said, nobody moves into the White House with me. And he said, oh, well, we didn't mean that, really. And he tried to sort of change the subject. But after she left, he said, come down and shoot some tests with me to see if I can forget the camera the way I did on the campaign trail. And that was the second film. It was called Adventures on the New Frontier. I shot his part of it in 2 days in the White House as a test to see if he could forget the camera.
And then in the third film, you actually capture the Bay of Pigs and Cuban Missile Crisis stories.
Not really. The third film was about a domestic crisis, the integration of University of Alabama, and the governor who wanted to stand in the schoolhouse door. But it turned out we couldn't. Every time a crisis came up, I would call Pierre Salinger, who was his press man, and say, Pierre, here's a crisis, let's shoot it. And he would say, wait a minute, and he'd leave the phone. He'd come back a few minutes later and say, how can you propose to do this at a time in a crisis like this? And I said, Pierre, that's the idea, remember? But anyway, a domestic crisis came along about integration.
In fact, you were in the room when Kennedy was being briefed about Vivian Malone and James Hood, the two black students who wanted to enroll in the University of Alabama. And maybe we should play a little clip, and then we can talk a bit more about how this thing happens.
And then if he still refuses, then Nick Katzenbach will say that we got this court order and we have to go through on a legal basis. He's made the test. This matter should be determined in the courts. It shouldn't be determined out here. He's had this opportunity and should let him go through, or otherwise we're going to have to take other steps because these students are going to attend the University of Alabama. Then if he still doesn't move, then we'll try to get by him.
Pushing?
Probably pushing a little bit. Just having somebody stand in front of him and try to walk through. There's three doors. We're going to try to have somebody inside who will open up one of the other doors so they can. Can't cover all three doors and just have the girls and the boys just try to go through another door. Anyway, that's going to be up to Nick Katzenbach as to how far we can go in that. If he's able to keep the doors locked and actually keep them out and it's going to require knocking them down or some real forceful action, then they will pull away. What we think then is that they'll go to their dormitories and say, well, we'll work out the registration sometime else. They'll go to their dormitories and
are they getting signed?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow, they really got into the nitty-gritty of that kind of planning. That, of course, was the voice mostly of Bobby Kennedy.
That's right.
There were others in the room, but was this typical that the two Kennedy brothers would just would engage in conversation to the exclusion of others?
I can't tell you that because I didn't spend that much time, but In regard to this integration of the University of Alabama, Bobby was the Attorney General. There was a court order ordering the integration, so it was up to the President and the Vice President, and the Attorney General, to enforce the court order. So they had a lot of give and take between themselves, And we did photograph it.
My guest is Robert Drew, the cinema verite pioneer, at least that's what we call him these days. His latest film, A President to Remember, in the company of John F. Kennedy. It is being screened as part of the Tribeca Film Festival, and you can see it tonight at 8:30 at the AMC Village on 11th Street. On Sunday at 1:45, also at the AMC 19th Street East. It was shown last night, also as part of the festival at the 19th Street. This film is a departure for you in a different way, isn't it? Because you have a voiceover narration, Alec Baldwin. I remember the last time you were here, you said that you never wanted to have a narrator, that you felt that the images should speak for themselves.
there's a bit of a difference between theory and practice. I would like to make films so well that they would tell their own story, like a movie. It turns out that sometimes I need transitional narration. Narration that doesn't tell the story, but it tells you where you are in time and what's up. And so this film happens to be a combination of four of my previous films, and we need transitions, and we needed a narrator. So some people complain that there's too little narration. They'd like to know more in this film. I think I pared it down to the minimum.
And some of the things that Alec Baldwin talks about are things that you couldn't show, or maybe you weren't even privy to at the time. Like he talks about Kennedy's dalliances, pain, and other imperfections, how Kennedy concealed them.
Yes, yes. I thought it was important to know that this man was in pain. All the time we were looking at him, he was in pain. And he was taking a lot of medicines and medications and painkillers. And I thought it was necessary to mention that his dalliances, somehow with all the pain and difficulty and being a president, he did manage to have a sort of invisible life that we couldn't know about. So I thought it was necessary to mention that.
Now, why have you put this film together now? Are you trying to show us that things have changed in the White House over the years? Or is it just that you realize you had this treasure trove of material on a president who many people still remember with great fondness, but in time, few living people will be able to remember?
Well, a little of everything, of all that, but the main thing is that right now we're in a depression. Our young people are depressed. Our perspectives on the presidency have been diminished. The numbers are of how people feel about the presidency are way down, below 30. In Kennedy's time, they were 70 and above, and people had an optimistic feeling about the country, about the presidency, about our future, and I felt it was a good idea to bring that example of Kennedy forward and give our people a taste of what it was like then and what it could be again with better luck and other presidents.
Well, when you started filming Primary, you had three colorful characters running for the office. You had Lyndon Johnson, Hubert Humphrey, and Kennedy.
Yeah.
And you decided to go with Kennedy. If you were filming the current primaries, would you choose one of the candidates?
I have to tell you, I stopped. I stopped trying to make films on presidents. After Kennedy's death, I was asked to make a film on Nixon running for president.
I was just being theoretical.
What's that?
I was being theoretical. If you were to make one, would you think that John McCain would be the most interesting subject? Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton? Because many people have compared Obama to Kennedy in the kind of appeal he has.
I'm afraid I make judgments long range, and some of them may be wrong, but I feel that there's probably only one candidate running who would have the confidence to let the camera live with him for a while.
And I'm going to guess which one that is privately.
It's a male. And it's a,
you
and
did it, say he.
And it's not a pre-Republican.
I see. Okay, I'll spend a little time trying to figure that one out. You had four films here, and they all worked very well on their own. So you must have had to make some serious sacrifices. How much footage did you cut out where you felt like you were going to cry if you had to cut it out?
Well, the four films amounted to about 4 hours, and the amount of my stuff that I shot in this current film is boiled down to maybe 30 or 40 minutes. So I did have to cut out a lot, but it wasn't hard because what stuck out were the things I wanted to tell anyway, and what stuck out mainly was Kennedy's smartness and his wit. There's more fun in this film than any film I've ever made on Kennedy and on politics.
Let's talk about the dark side for a moment. Where were you when he was assassinated?
I was walking down the street in New York City. Actually, I don't smoke and I don't like cigars, but I was looking in a cigar store window for some reason, and a tinny microphone above gave the bad news. And when I got back to my office, I got a phone call from Elmer Lauer, who was president of ABC News, who said, go to Washington and make a film on the death of Kennedy. And I said, what kind of film? And he said, your kind of film, and hung up. So I went to Washington without any guidance, but knowing that everybody, all the networks, would be shooting the same thing. So I decided to shoot backwards, and I shot people's faces. And so I told the story of the funeral through people's faces.
The grieving faces of people in response to the assassination. And you didn't include in this film any of the famous footage, not because you didn't shoot it. You have included other people's footage, haven't you?
I missed the question, sorry.
You didn't include in this all of the assassination footage that we already know.
Oh, no. Well, I was feeling on the edge of not being able to control my emotions. That was true of everybody around me. And so during the funeral, I shot close-ups of faces of people not being able to, on the edge of not being able to control their emotions. And it's called Faces November, and I had no idea whether people would like it or not, but
it's very moving.
It wasn't broadcast in this country, but it won two first prizes at Venice, and so I guess people liked it.
If you want to know more about the screenings of this film, A President to Remember, in the company of John F. Kennedy by Robert Drew, you can check out all of the information on our show page at WNYC.org. And my great thanks to Robert Drew for being our guest again today on the show.
Well, thank you.
Politicians have been portrayed as everything from corrupt candidates to virtuous do-gooders throughout the history of American movies. Each month from now until Election Day, we'll take a different look at politics on the silver screen. For this first installment of Political Projections, the topic is how Hollywood has depicted political campaigns. And the four films that we've chosen to discuss are Primary, Tanner 88, The War Room, and Primary Colors. It is my great pleasure to welcome D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hegedus back to this show. They're the co-directors of The War Room, and Mr. Pennebaker was one of the photographers and editors of the classic documentary Primary. And joining them is Tad Devine, a veteran political consultant who's worked at the highest levels of the last two presidential campaigns as senior strategist to Gore Lieberman and senior advisor and strategist to John Kerry for the primaries and general elections. Welcome to you all to Political Projections.
Hi. By the way, if you in the audience want to add your 2 cents, please leave a comment on our show page or give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. D.A., Primary has been credited with initiating the cinema verite documentary style with its depiction of the 1960 Democratic primary between John F. Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey. How were those candidates chosen, and why did the film only look at their contest in Wisconsin?
Well, it was kind of an early sally for Life, the magazine that did it, for whom we were working.
Life magazine saw this as an extension of what it did in the magazine?
Well, I was never sure. Bob Drew, who was an editor there, he edited there was a thing called the back of the book, and they would show peculiar things that had happened the week before. And he took on, because he'd become a Nieman Fellow, he took on the process of trying to set up a whole sort of candid filmmaking operation at the magazine, which they were interested in. And I kind of think at the time that they thought maybe they would buy ABC or something, and this would give them a way to, whatever it is, to move into the door.
But in the end, the hope of the film was to be as honest and as objective as possible, wasn't it?
I think the hope of the film was to do something with Kennedy. Bob and all of us actually saw Kennedy as a kind of a helmsman of a new adventure that we were about to have. And
You assumed he was going to win?
Yeah. Win or lose, we assumed that he was the new voice, the new generation. I mean, the shots of him walking down the street with his hair blowing in the wind, people didn't have shots like that of future presidents in the prior life.
You're disillusioning me. I always thought that documentaries weren't intended to promote one side or another.
Well, it wasn't to promote him. It's just that we loved him in a funny way. And the documentary film is an offering of love by the makers. That's what makes it work, and it also flaws it.
Tad, in Primary, we see Hubert Humphrey handing out business cards in the streets of Wisconsin. And in Primary Colors, Governor Jack Stanton, who's based on Bill Clinton, is shaking hands with ordinary voters. So has nothing changed over all the years of campaigning?
Well, I think a lot has changed. You know, I was honestly, I had not seen Primary until today. I regret to say that, and I watched it because I knew I'd be talking to you. And
were you surprised at how great a film it is?
It's just an extraordinary film, and I was affected by it. And I think the thing that struck me is how much things have changed and how little things have changed. You know,
yeah.
At the same time. I mean, it's extraordinary to see presidential candidates walking around without Secret Service, without the entourage, with everything else. Hubert Humphrey handing out a card in the middle of a street, giving a speech to a group of farmers in Wisconsin, lambasting the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Wall Street Journal, you know, and then Senator Kennedy being, you know, as D.A. says, someone who's just extraordinary, that you point the camera at him and he comes right through the lens.
Well, has television made campaigns less about face-to-face meetings except for in Iowa and New Hampshire?
Yeah, I think television has, but I think that, you know, what's happened, the biggest thing I think that's happened is, you know, and a lot of it happened in the wake of the Kennedy assassination and the way, you know, American politics have changed over the years, is that we have such separation between candidates and people now. You know, and television certainly contributes to a lot to it, but also security concerns, the way that the world has changed in the years between 1960 and today. So, you know, that's a striking thing for me. But I think the thing that hasn't changed is you've either got it or you don't have it when it comes to being a candidate for president. You know, Jack Kennedy had it. I mean, you know, when he talked to people, whether it was in a hall in Milwaukee or whether it was through a television program, he was connecting with voters. And I think presidential candidates today, I mean, the other thing I was struck about just watching Primary today is the similarities between Jack Kennedy and also Jacqueline Kennedy and the Obamas, that you have someone so dynamic, a husband and wife, who have such presence and such grace and are, I think, connecting with people in a way that the Kennedys did so long ago. So I think, you know, yeah, things have changed a lot, but in many ways things have remained the same.
I'm talking with Tad Devine, who is a political consultant. And with filmmakers D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hegedus, this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We have a clip from Primary where Hubert Humphrey is speaking in a Wisconsin gym to a group of farmers. And notice how he's playing up his Midwest rural credentials.
Yeah. I can tell you that my votes aren't very popular sometimes in New York City or Boston. Because back there, what they want in the new, when I read the editorials, the Wall Street Journal, Boston Globe, New York Times, they want a price support program that's lower. They say that the farmer is being subsidized. And they look at Hubert Humphrey's record and they say, well, this Humphrey, he's just from the Midwest. He's just for those farmers. That's what they say. They're right. I am.
D.A., that's nothing new. I mean, we're still seeing that today where politicians campaign on the city-country eastern establishment divide.
Yeah. The thing about Hubert Humphrey that was, and we really got to know him pretty well, actually, later, not just there, but later at the inauguration, we put a wireless mic on him because he was going to be sitting near Kennedy. And we were filming from across the street, but we had no sound. And he was happy to do it for us. He couldn't have been a more accommodating person.
He was a truly happy warrior?
Sort of. But, you know, the problem with him was that we all saw him as kind of a nerd. And in a way, that was his appeal in farmland, I suppose. But also, he didn't differentiate us from people who were reporting and going back and writing stories. He kept saying our copy desk editors. He didn't understand television at all.
Now, Tad, do you advise people you're working for to stress that anti-Eastern establishment theme if they can?
Well, I guess it depends where you are, you know.
You can't help John Kerry.
Well, listen, I think what's important with candidates now is not so much the theme but the authenticity of the candidates. I think campaigns become powerful when, you know, candidates are captured, as they are, by the way, in these documentaries. But when campaigns can capture candidates and can get as close to the people as possible with the real candidates. And when those candidates, whether it's their biography or the positions they've taken on issues, match up with the mood of a country, then campaigns get powerful.
Now, Chris, you've documented both primary and general elections. Is there much of a difference in the way the candidates present themselves in each?
Well, they're different parts of the same process, but they're being hit by things all the way through, and I'm sure that anybody who's worked on campaigns, you know, can attest to that type of thing. But I think what all these films get at is kind of what was just said, is the authenticity of the candidate, and I think that rings through for audiences. And I think what you saw in all these films were people wanting to find somebody who they could relate to, who they thought was true, who was real, kind of in the Tanner way when they were talking about the real person.
But they have to change when they're in different parts of the country. On primaries, they can actually focus their message a lot more specifically.
Right.
Later, they have to keep the national story in mind.
Right. And that's, I think, why that authentic sense is so important, that people feel that. And I think that, you know, that's what people aren't feeling maybe from Hillary at this point. And, you know, I think the press kind of feeds into this in different ways, good and bad. I mean, now we're on a news cycle that's, you know, unprecedentedly fast, which has its good and bad points. I mean, just recently reading about Hillary in the paper where, you know, in the debate, you know, came up, but people didn't like you. And her response, if you just read her response, you kind of felt one thing. And then actually seeing her response, I felt something totally different. I felt she was very sympathetic. And so it's very interesting.
Now, Tad, you have also run campaigns abroad. Is the campaigning approach similar, or is the glad handing something that's uniquely American?
No, it's very similar. And I was actually in a documentary called Our Brand is Crisis, which was about the Bolivian presidential election in 2002. And that was much sort of a war room for foreign campaigns. And, you know, and it's amazing to me, and I've worked in 9 countries, I think, outside the U.S., and, you know, how similar our campaigns are. Sure, they're very different in terms of the customs and, you know, the places and the people in different countries. But what's happening, I think, in politics all around the world is that for good or for bad, you know, what we do here in the United States and do a lot of, which is broad-based communication, using television to get to people, polling and research to try to define message, all the tools of modern campaigning are being utilized more frequently around the world. And so what we wind up seeing, I think, are that campaigns in other countries are looking more and more like the campaigns here, for better or for worse.
We have a clip from the War Room that we'd like to play. This takes place on the eve of the general election. George Stephanopoulos, who was Clinton's communications director, is praising James Carville, the chief political consultant, for coining the campaign's 3 major mottos.
Besides Bill Clinton, one person really gave this campaign focus. And one person wrote what I call a haiku about 5 months ago. Change versus more of the same. The economy's stupid. I think if you did a nexus, it would come up in about 1,000 places. And don't forget healthcare. You know, I was kidding James yesterday. I said he's about to pass from the role of regular human being into the role of a legend. And I think he really deserves it. Because probably for the first time in a generation tomorrow, we're going to win.
Ted, do you think those 3 slogans with Iraq thrown in will be used just as much in the upcoming campaign?
I do, although I think our politics have changed a lot since 1992, and I think that's beginning to emerge in this presidential election. I think people have in America have been affected by the polarization of American politics, and that's something I think, unfortunately, I regret to say that both parties are guilty of. And so I think we're seeing now in the primary process, we'll see what happens in New Hampshire today, but I expect it will be a lot like what happened a few days ago in Iowa, that voters are coming out and they're making a statement. And I think what they're trying to tell us is, listen, the politics that Washington has practiced with the Democrats on one side, the Republicans on the other side, is no longer acceptable to America. And so I think that theme, which is transcends an individual issue, but instead speaks to the politics of our nation and whether or not the Democrats and the Republicans are going to begin to work together for a common cause, may in fact become the most powerful force in American politics this year.
DA, in the War Room, we see that the campaign has a number of scripts for each issue, for example, a health care script. What goes into writing those scripts? Did you were you able to film the thinking into writing them?
Well, filming writing is like
I mean, you must have heard them talking.
Taste pudding over the air, you know. It lacks a certain complete junction. But I don't, you know, the people writing the script for a president, I think is, there's a presidential club, and you join it, you know, by having a lot of money, basically. Poor people aren't invited generally. But that club practices a kind of, a funny kind of orthodoxy. That is that, and we thought of this when we were originally when we did the War Room. We wanted to see a man become president, because I'd started a film like that with Bobby, and I just couldn't do it. It was too complicated, too expensive, and way beyond me. So I never did it. But we talked about it, and I shot a lot with him about it, because he and his brother had a kind of arrogance that they didn't care about the presidential club. They were willing to say anything that, you know, they'd say anything that popped into their head. But I think generally you're not going to get a view of people running for high office which is very human. You're going to get this funny front parlor talk. And I think we were spared that. We thought we were going to try to shoot that kind of a film with Clinton. But luckily we got thrown out of that and instead went with George and James, which was probably a much more realistic thing. But, you know, it never occurred to me while we were doing it that we were making a political film, because I feel so naive about politics myself. You know, I'm ready to vote for the first person whose face I like, you know. And the fact is that in that, what we finally got were the people who represented this generational jump. And I think, and I was sort of interested to hear what our phantom other person here said. I'm sorry I can't see him because I hear what he says and I want to look at his face and there's no face here.
Well, he's in Washington, D.C. Right?
Well, you can visit my website at Divine Mulvey and you can see me there.
Oh, that would be good. That would be good. Because so, I think that the fact is that this club really maintains a very... It's really hard for people to break into what's really going on because there's so much money. I suspect that until the problem of the money gets solved, and it doesn't look like it's going to any day soon, of campaign financing, I don't think anything's really going to change much. But I'd be curious, knowing what you do, being in Washington, if you do see some change.
Well, listen, I think this, we're going to find out this year because we've got an election that is about change. And, you know, I've done a lot of elections around the world, particularly in Latin America, where change is the message. You know, you can reduce a campaign to a single word, cambio. You know, you say it over and over again, and you win the election, you become president of X nation. And I think that impulse has reached America. We saw some of this in 1992. I think when Bill Clinton ran, he talked a lot about change in a compelling way, and it's one of the big reasons he was elected president. And I think now, though, the impulse for change has become so big that it may, in fact, overwhelm the things that you're talking about, all these forces and the power of money and everything else which has so dominated our politics for the last, couple of decades. I think there is a real opportunity in 2008 for change to happen, particularly if you have change candidates. And, I think Obama certainly represents that. I know John Edwards, whose campaign for Senate I worked on when he ran in North Carolina, certainly wants to represent that. And I know Hillary wants to, too. I think she's just having a very difficult time figuring out how to get there.
Well, they're all using the word change, and the Republicans as well. We have to take a little break, and we'll come back with more from our guest, Tad Devine, who's a veteran political consultant, and filmmakers D.A. Pennybaker and Chris Hegedus. This is WNYC. Stay with us.
Exercise your right to vote. Choose the one you like the most. It's your individual right to choose the one you want to fight for you. Mm-hmm. Pick the proper candidate. You can change the course of fate. It's a decision that you must make. Select the one you think is great for you.
As part of a new series starting today called Political Projections, we're talking with filmmakers D.A. Pennybaker and Chris Hegedus, and with veteran political consultant Tad Devine, about the way the political process, in this case the primaries, have been depicted in the films. And Chris, I'm sure you've seen Primary Colors, which covered the same campaign that you and D.A. covered in the War Room. Did you feel it was accurate at all? Was it anything like what you saw?
I remember just, being as curious as everyone was when the book came out and who wrote it and that whole scenario. And then seeing the movie, I think initially I was disappointed by it. I felt that, Billy Bob Thornton, was, not at all like James Carville, and kind of they missed
the point.
Well, we
would hope James Carville is a little classier.
Yeah, I mean, they just kind of missed the point and the genius and kind of the wonderfulness of James Carville. So I was disappointed, but I just watched it. And, I appreciated it in a different way. And I think a lot of it is just because, today is the New Hampshire primary. And some of the messages in the film about, what people are really getting at when they want to elect somebody, because they're going to be thrown all these, hard balls along the way. But in the end, you want a person who is going to do something and not a person who's going for it because it's a prize. And I think there are candidates out there that are going for it because it's a prize and not because they want to do things. And I think that still resonates.
Well, what happened with those hard balls during the War Room shooting when Jennifer Flowers popped up?
Well, I mean, that's the interesting thing about our films is that they're history and they're part of history. I mean, when you start the War Room, it starts with Jennifer Flowers as, one of these big issues that's thrown at Clinton. And, of course, he denies it and it kind of went away. And there were hints about the tape being cut up and a lot of the things that we see in primary colors. But we didn't really know. But then, you know, 10 years later, you know, a different scenario came out with Monica Lewinsky and Jennifer Flowers.
Tad, when you watch these films, and I'm sure you've seen some other films about the political process, is your response, gee, that's pretty good, or boy, did they miss the point?
Well, you know, it depends on the film. I mean, I think the documentaries that we've talked about today and others as well, I think they're very accurate, I mean, and insightful, and I think they give people a real feel for what actually goes on in campaigns. I think when you get something like, you know, Primary Colors, I think you're really dealing with, you know, fiction and acting and storytelling, and, you know, and I think that's very much separate and apart from the way real campaigns operate.
Well, let's play a clip from Primary Colors. This is a scene right before the end where Governor Jack Stanton explains to his young campaign manager what elections are all about.
This is it, Henry. This is the price you pay to lead. You don't think that Abraham Lincoln was a whore before he was a president? He had to tell his little stories and smile his backcountry grin. And he did it just so that he would one day have the opportunity to stand in front of the nation and appeal to the better angels of our nature. And that's where the stops. That's what it's all about, so we have the opportunity to make the most of it, to do it the right way. And you know as well as I do, there are plenty of people playing this game that don't think that way. They're willing to sell their souls, crawl through sewers, lie to people, divide them, play on the worst fears for nothing, just for the prize.
So the suggestion there is that you may do anything that you have to do to win the election, but once you become the president, you then can do good. It doesn't always work out that way, does it?
In this fact, has been an old argument. I mean, many philosophers of Kant, for one, have confronted this, and the thing about In Colors. They start off by saying any lie you have to tell to win is worthwhile. But in the end, they kind of back off from that. I thought the writing, the script writing in that, and I had realized it was Elaine May. Yeah. I had forgotten that. But I thought when I saw it again, I thought the writing was very good in a funny sense in that it really tried to capture both sides of an unsolvable dilemma.
But does it say something about what we'd like to think about the political process, that it can get dirty during the campaigns, but then in the end, the president will do the best job possible and not betray the country? You're nodding your head, Chris.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that's what drives an election, even, you know, with Obama.
The fantasy, anyway.
Is the fantasy, is the hope. And I think, you know, without some kind of hope, it's, you know, cynicism, and I don't know. It'd be interesting to hear what you think, having been involved.
Well, I think those of us, you know, who work on campaigns and you get involved in them, we recognize, you know, particularly our campaigns in America in recent years, they've become pretty tough, and it's tough stuff. And if you got to have the stomach to sort of, you know, get through it and to deal with it. And I think the reason that we do and we're willing to, you know, get down there and slug it out a lot of times is because we believe that in government you can do great things. Or if the government is led in the wrong direction, terrible things can happen to your country. And I think that makes the stakes of campaigns so high. And I think as a result, when you're in them, you're willing to do things that, you know, you probably wouldn't do in a government. And, you know, and so I think there is a lot of truth to that. I think, you know, as the stakes have gone higher and so much has happened to this country in recent years, you know, I think people are willing to do more and more to get that power. Now, whether or not we can have this transition to a point where people sort of take that power and then do good, I don't think we've seen an awful lot of that recently, and we'll have to wait and see what this election does.
So let me ask you about two decisions that were made during two campaigns you were involved with. You were serving as a senior strategist for Al Gore's 2000 presidential campaign.
Right.
How was the decision made to distance Gore from Clinton during that campaign? And then, of course, I have to bring up the other case, John Kerry deciding not to immediately respond to the Swift boat accusations.
Yeah. Well, two, you know, we could talk about each of those for a couple of hours, but I'll try to give you a brief synopsis. You know, I think the decision about, you know, in the Gore campaign to have the vice president put some distance between himself and the president was absolutely the right decision. Al Gore at the convention, when he stood up in his acceptance speech and said, "Tonight I stand here as my own man," I think achieved what every vice president needs to achieve when they have a strong president, whether it was the president, Bush's father, or Al Gore, you know, who they've served with. And by the way, I think it's what Hillary Clinton probably needs to achieve today, ironically, you know, after being the first lady and being married to someone who casts a very long shadow. The vice president needs to separate themselves properly and appropriately from the president to be seen in their own right and to have a chance to turn and pivot to the future. So I think that decision about Gore distancing himself in many ways was certainly driven by the research of that campaign. We talked to people. They wanted a debate about the future, not about the past. I think that's a debate that people want today as well, and I think that's one of the things that Hillary's going to have to confront in the days ahead. Now, as to Kerry, and, you know, 4 years later, and, you know, sort of the Swift boat, I mean, listen, obviously another very, very difficult decision and time. I think we made a mistake, and I said so at the time when we made a decision not to accept public funding in the general election, and that decision led us to a situation where in the course of, you know, the month of August of 2004, we simply had no means of, you know, running a paid media campaign response against a paid media attack, you know, because we were going to spend dollars in August that we needed to save for October. That's kind of an inside argument. I think in retrospect, obviously, when you look back with 2020 hindsight, as soon as any attack against John's record in Vietnam came, you know, we should have recognized it more as an opportunity than what it turned out to be. I don't think in the end that wound up, you know, costing John the election. I think the election in 2004 was decided mostly on the events of September 11, 2001 than anything that happened in Vietnam or anything that happened in 2004.
Did all of you watch Tanner 88?
Yes.
I know you did.
Watched it all.
Yeah. It suggests that campaigning can be exhausting, tedious, dehumanizing. And we see the main candidate attempting to be real. Do you think that Altman and Gary Trudeau really caught the spirit of a campaign, other than the fact that they made one of the most hilarious television shows in the history of the world?
Well, we sort of thought it surprised me. I had only seen a little piece of it at the time, so I looked very curious. I think a lot of it works because I don't think you can show a lot of the kinds of internal manipulation with real people, with documentary. And this way, it's shown in a kind of story form. It's interesting that the climax is not the election itself, although they show a kind of an election, but it's his making do with failing somehow to bring off of some kind of thing which you don't really understand very well. But the idea for us, of course, it was simple for us. He was either going to get elected or he wasn't. And that was our climax. We didn't have to build one in as a story form.
But I would assume, Tad, that the most successful candidates like Bill Clinton are the ones who can communicate a sense that they genuinely care about ordinary people.
Yeah, I think so. And I think successful candidates are also candidates who fit the times. And I think in 1992, you know, Bill Clinton very much fit the times. The country was ready to move on. They wanted a change in direction. The change vote was overwhelming. I mean, when you think of the, you know, it wasn't just the Clinton vote, it was the Perot vote as well. So you had about 60% of the American people saying, listen, we're not taking this anymore. We want to go in a different direction. And I think Clinton, of all the candidates that year, best suited the times. And I think this election really is going to be about finding the candidate from both parties and ultimately the one who suits these times the best.
And it's surprisingly, we have a situation where there are so many unconventional candidates here. A woman, a serious black candidate, a Mormon, a man who believes in creationism. What a range we have. But I guess that's part of what makes America great. We've pretty much run out of time, but I do want to also mention that D.A. Pennybaker's Don't Look Back, which has nothing to do with this, although it's a fabulous film. We'll be having a one-week run at the Film Forum beginning Friday, February 1st, right?
Right.
And you may be interested in knowing that our next installment on Tuesday, February 5th, will take a look at political comedies. The movies will be Dave, the American President, and Dr. Strangelove. And we will also be doing something that we didn't do here. We'll be holding a screening event on Monday, February 4th, where we'll show one of the movies to be discussed. And listeners should
pay attention to our website for more details and to post your reactions. Ted, are you working for any candidates in this election?
Not in this presidential campaign, no. It's the first one I've sat on in a long time, and I've enjoyed watching it on TV.
Because you really didn't want to choose one of the candidates?
Well, no. I mean, in recent years, I've spent a lot of my time actually out of the country. I spent all of the month of May last year in Dublin helping Fianna Fáil and Bertie Ahern win a third consecutive term. I've been working in Europe and a lot of other places. So I think presidential campaigns in the U.S., you know, you've just got to commit basically your life to them. And having done that several times, I really am sort of in a different place this time. So
Chris,
I'm enjoying watching it, though. I really am.
Do you wish that you were out there filming one of these candidates?
You know, listen, when you watch it, you know, you do miss the action, and it is enjoyable. When I hear about Tanner, I think, you know, I worked for Governor Dukakis in 1988, and I remember, and I was actually Lloyd Benson's campaign manager when he ran for vice president in that general election. And you know, the events that come back from those years, and I remember watching Tanner, and actually Gary Trudeau came into the convention trailer.
Got to leave it there, unfortunately. Well, some other time on Gary Trudeau's story, but thanks, Tad Devine, D.A. Pennybaker, and Chris Hegedus.